Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now is Emily Bazelon, legal affairs watcher and more for the New York Times Magazine and Yale Law School, and member of the Slate Political Gab Fest, which this week is called the She Was Just 17, You Know What I Mean edition. And yes, you all know what that means right now. Hi, Emily. Happy Thanksgiving. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
So you're a legal affairs watcher, among other things, and Roy Moore's background is as a judge. What aspect of this story are you especially interested in right now?
Well, I mean, I think the part that is the hardest to swallow is the backing he continues to receive in Alabama and the way in which he's gone after the women who have accused him of sexual misconduct. It's just hard to square that with the values that, you know, that one expects social conservatives to uphold.
53% of white women voted for Trump after the Access Hollywood tape came out. Any reason to think it would be different for Roy Moore in the Me Too moment?
I do think there's reason to be different because this time there are underage girls involved. And I think that, you know, I interviewed women after the election about their support for Trump, white women, and they were willing to dismiss the Access Hollywood tape as locker room talk. That was what Trump wanted people to think, and they kind of went for that. But if you start really reading these allegations about Roy Moore, it's like a parent's worst nightmare of someone who was really in a predatory way, allegedly, going after girls, you know, at the mall, even calling them at school. And the original allegation from Lee Korfman, who was 14 when she approached Trump, you know, her story is of being at a very vulnerable moment in her life. She was at a custody hearing that her mother was having. And it sounds like she was lonely and Moore really took advantage of that. So I would think a lot of moms out there would be horrified by that set of allegations.
But here was what might have been the biggest Roy Moore development of the weekend. We played this clip about an hour ago, but I'm going to replay it because it's the governor of Alabama, who is a woman, Kay Ivey, and she did say that she had no reason to disbelieve the women who've been coming forward, but nevertheless, she went on to say this.
I will cast my ballot on December the 12th, and I do believe that the nominee of the party is the one I'll vote for. I believe in the Republican Party and what we stand for, and most important, we need to have a Republican in the United States Senate to vote on the things like Supreme Court justices, other appointments that the Senate has to confirm and make major decisions. And so that's what I plan to do, is vote for the Republican nominee, Roy Moore.
So Governor Ivey just threw a lot of Alabama women into, you know, major psychological dissonance and in conflict with themselves, or she just gave many people permission to do what they want to do anyway and ignore this and vote for the Republican.
Right. Well, I wonder, though, if this is the kind of moral compromise that a politician might be more willing to make than like a regular person voting. You know, it's one thing for Kay Ivey to say that she sees this transaction as being worth it, right? That the votes that Moore will cast in the Senate mean that she's going to look beyond his personal conduct. That in essence, if she believes these allegations, then she's saying that she can't imagine anything to be disqualifying. But I would imagine that a lot of regular people just might not see it that way.
Yeah. Have you thought about this for yourself? Like, if the, not to presume how you vote, but if the shoe is on the other foot, and somebody who you thought had done disgusting, horrible, you know, personal things at this level, but you didn't want the next Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. Maybe you wanted the next Ruth Bader Ginsburg or something like that, and thought that was so consequential for the future of the republic that you might swallow your judgment and vote for that person anyway.
I mean, this is like a kind of the ultimate utilitarian test about voting, right? You imagine a candidate you would otherwise support doing something that you find disgusting and that you believe is true. And, you know, there are many women who've come forward. These stories seem plausible. There's a lot of corroboration for them. I don't think I would vote for someone like Roy Moore, no matter what. I know other people might make other choices, but to me, this is just beyond the pale, and I just wouldn't be able to do it.
And listeners on this or anything else for Emily Bazelon, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let me go on to another aspect of this, because Doug Jones, the Democrat, is leading in the last few polls, including the Fox News poll that came out the other day. We don't know after last year's polls how reflective that is of people who may not want to tell pollsters that they're going to vote for Roy Moore at the moment, but really intend to. So who knows how this election is going to turn out, and there's a few weeks to go yet anyway, during which anything can happen. But let's say Doug Jones wins. A Democrat, what a fluke, a Democrat being elected senator from Alabama, of all places, because of Roy Moore's sudden unacceptability, if it turns out to be that way. I wonder if Jones then becomes kind of a test case of whether Democrats can rebuild a political base among white voters, especially white Southern, white rural, white working class, non-college educated voters, you know, based on economic policy or whatever, while still not abandoning the values of equality that the Democrats have come to stand for. It would be a marvelous opportunity to set an example for Democratic candidates around the country, it seems to me, if in fact he wins.
Right. I mean, then you wonder how much people in other states are going to pay attention to, you know, Alabama's senator. But there is an opportunity there for sure. And I think it's also important to bring out the way in which Roy Moore's candidacy, even without these horrifying allegations of sexual misconduct with teenagers, even without all of that, he was a fringe candidate. I mean, he's made his whole career out of defying, you know, other courts when they told him to take the Ten Commandments monument out of the Alabama courthouse, refusing to comply with the Supreme Court's gay marriage order. So there's a way in which he is really representing this Trumpian rebellious right. wing of the Republican Party.
But like Trump, he was a fringe candidate who kept winning election. I mean, Trump only won one election, but Roy Moore, oh, fringe candidate. He defied Supreme Court orders. He did all this stuff. And then he'd win again.
That's right. And so if he is elected, despite all of this, that is going to show us that at least in Alabama, that is a kind of appeal to voters that's really pretty strong. If he loses, though, it will be an indication that that's not necessarily a ripe future for the Republican Party, even in a deep red state. So, you know, in a sense, the narrative, our kind of political consciousness, there's quite a lot hinging on this race, even though you could also argue that we'd be overinterpreting it because this is such an extreme set of allegations and facts at this point that maybe it doesn't really apply to any other race.
I want to talk to you about Trump remaking the judiciary while people pay attention to other things. But we have some phone calls coming in response to this. So let's take a few of them first. Edward in Yorkville, you're on WNYC. You wanted to react to the Governor Kay Ivey clip?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Brian. She said directly, she didn't even imply it. She said, we need a Republican in the Senate to vote for judicial nominations and to vote, you know, for things like that for the Republican Party, however she worded it. And and I heard that clip when you played it earlier, and it strikes me all the time how Republicans are very good at driving home to their voters, you know, whatever you think about this person, set it aside, and we need to confirm these judges. We need to, you know, that for some reason is very effective. And Democrats, to the extent that they try, it doesn't seem to work as well. And I think I've heard Emily Bazelon talk about that on the Gabfest even. I mean, this is like a perennial problem for Democrats, it seems to me. And I despair of this, but I'm not sure I just wonder if either of you have a reaction to that, because it does seem like an insuperable problem.
Emily, is this something you have spoken about?
Yes. I mean, I think that's right. Conservatives traditionally have been better at calling attention to the courts. They tend to keep their eye on the ball with the courts. And this is partly because of Roe versus Wade. They feel great urgency about overturning Roe versus Wade. And I think to some degree, the fact that abortion is still relatively accessible, at least in most of the country, means that liberals have been more complacent about the courts. You see this in the slower pace of filling judicial vacancies in the Obama administration, and the way in which the fact that Merrick Garland's nomination got blocked by the Republicans in the Senate didn't seem to really galvanize enough Democratic voters to make a huge difference. So, yeah, I agree.
Brian in Bushwick, also on the KIV clip. Brian, you're on WNYC.
Hi, thanks, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, about KIV, I'm a Democrat, as you were talking about in your last segment, and I started to see, just as you were saying it, the idea of, well, what if I put myself in their shoes? But the thing with KIV is that she didn't say what is normally said, which is, you know, these haven't been proven yet, so I'm going to support them until then. She said she has no reason to disbelieve, and which is kind of saying she believes them, yet she's still going to support them. So that just really seems to really kind of cross a line as far as, you know, still supporting him when she says she has no reason to disbelieve. She could, you know, she could respectfully say, well, we have to see how this plays out, but until then. But she didn't say that. She said she doesn't,
right,
you know, disbelieve them. And I have a second point about Trump.
Well, let me follow it up with putting the shoe back on the other foot. So for you as a Democrat, since it sounds like you started to ask yourself that question, what if the shoe was on the other foot and you felt the future of the country was at stake with who would be confirmed to the Supreme Court and everything else, and you believed women making equivalent allegations against a Democrat who was running, would you vote for the Republican?
If I believe them, I would have, if I honestly believe them. But the thing is, I try to, because of all the scandals that have happened, I really, and I've seen a lot of other scandals in other parts of the community that aren't as, you know, famous and notorious, but I really try to, you know, stick to, you know, something being proven. But I have to agree, I would have a very hard time with it because of, you know, the allegations being very close, and the fact that he also only, I think it said, specifically denied the two very young women, but the other ones he didn't really make as much of a denial about, and that sounds pretty suspicious. So I would be really perplexed, and I might even, as a, you know, as just as a pure morality, just have to say, hey, you know, I gotta vote against this guy.
Brian, thank you very much. I don't even think he denied. I mean, denied the 14-year-old, but some of the others, 16, 17, 18, Emily basically said, I asked their mothers. And some of the reporting in the Washington Post is that, you know, the mother of one of the seven, I think a 17-year-old girl who said, what if I told you I was going out with an older man? She said, oh, I don't know about that. She said, what if I told you it was Roy Moore? And she said, I'd say you're the luckiest girl in the world, according to the Washington Post.
Yeah, there's just some weird parts of this that I feel like I don't totally understand in terms of the culture at the time, the degree to which, you know, lots of people were warning girls to stay away from Roy Moore versus other people who seem to have a response to him like, well, he's the district attorney, he's a powerful man, that could be a good thing for you. It's confusing.
Nora in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nora.
Hi. So I just want to say I really, you know, I listen to the Gabfest every week, and I really think Emily is great. Which led me to make this call because, you know, I am so perplexed about this question. I really don't know. I mean, I don't have, you know, it's not in front of me right now.
You're talking about Al Franken now?
Yeah, Al Franken. I just, you know, so I'm not a Minnesota voter, so I don't have to make this decision, but probably someday I will, and I have no idea how I would do it. You know, if it was someone as, you know, progressive, as far as I knew, as Al Franken, but who had you know, been revealed to, you know, sexually harass somebody.
Yeah. Well, in the and Emily, I don't know if you've taken a position on this, whether he should resign. We had New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg on Friday, who says that he should. After all, the governor of Minnesota, unlike the governor of Alabama, is a Democrat. So Al Franken would be replaced with another progressive Democrat, presumably. And do you want somebody who did the things that he's accused of and I guess acknowledged doing? I mean, he says that Leanne Tweeden, his victim, remembers that comedy show rehearsal differently than he does. But basically, he's not denying that he gave her an unwanted and one that she even kind of said, no, I don't want to rehearse that scene, big wet kiss that, you know, she described as thrusting his tongue down her throat. I mean, you probably want somebody in your workplace to be fired if they did that, right?
Yeah, there's new allegations against Franken this morning, too, where a second woman.
I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, a second woman is saying that she took a picture with him at a state fair and he grabbed her buttocks when she did that. So, I mean, my feeling about Franken was I wanted to see what else was going to come out, whether there was a pattern here. Now that that is looking more like that may be the case, that makes me lean more toward agreeing with Michelle about him resigning. I do think there's something confusing, or at least worth thinking about here. You know, in the court of public opinion, we don't have a clear way of differentiating between different kinds of offenses. You know, Roy Moore, in a predatory manner, chasing underage girls is different from what Franken's accused of. I'm not excusing Franken. You know, what you just said about firing someone might be the case, but we don't really have a clear way of like imposing different kinds of punishments on people. We just kind of sort it out as it happens. And so that I'm not quite sure what to do about that.
Here's more on that, since everybody's wondering now, just as I was. I just did a quick search and came up with this brand new Washington Post article. Is Senator Al Franken a serial groper? That's the question inevitably raised now that a second woman is saying Franken grabbed her inappropriately, this time when he was taking a photo with her in 2010 at the Minnesota State Fair. He, quote, pulled me in really close, like awkward close, and as my husband took the picture, he put his hand full-fledged on my rear, Lindsay Menz told CNN. It was wrapped tightly around my butt cheek, said this woman, Lindsay Menz. So I guess that's the second allegation. And again, oddly enough, it was something that was being done on camera. Who did he think he was, George H.W. Bush?
Seriously, I mean, there is a way in which we're having like an outbreak of allegations of misconduct, and that is really dismaying. And I was saying the other day to my husband that I actually found it surprising the number of allegations. And then, as like a lot of people, we were kind of talking about whether it is in fact surprising. It's not like we didn't know all of this was out there. And I think a lot of women have experienced this ourselves. And yet there is something quite shocking about how many men are now being tarred with this brush.
So how do you feel as just a woman, female human being, you know, not to mention a professional who writes and thinks about right and wrong in the world and what needs to be done to right wrongs? You know, globally or with respect to politics or journalism?
Well, I feel a sense of a lot of alarm and protectiveness on behalf of younger women right now. And mostly that has to do with thinking back on my younger self, because when things like this were happening to me, I was younger than I am now. And I feel kind of sense of heartbreak for how much complicity I felt then, for how just like totally unable I felt to speak up. And I really want younger women to not be in this position now. And I do find it encouraging that younger women are coming forward and sticking up for themselves and seem to just feel like they are entitled to draw a line in the sand and entitled to not put up with behavior that in the 90s, 20 years ago, I did not feel like I had the same sort of choice about.
Is that what you meant when you said complicit a minute ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I mean by complicit is that we all have been part of workplaces where people, or at least I feel like I've been part of workplaces, had experiences where men crossed the line, and I didn't speak out against them at the time. It's easier now to look back and think like, wow, that was really bad. I should have said something. But in the moment, I just didn't think there was any chance that I was going to be taken seriously. And it was always part of some complicated set of dynamics in which I could blame myself in some way. I think a lot of women have that feeling. And so that's what I mean by complicit.
Emily Bazelon with us. From the New York Times Magazine and Yale Law School and the Slate Political Gabfest. Let's talk about Trump remaking the judiciary, because while he distracts us with tweets about Al Franken and basketball dad LeVar Ball and everything else, he's getting all these judges in with the Republican Senate. And for you as a legal affairs watcher, you're probably more up on this than most people. How monumental is this?
It's a huge shift. So Trump came into office with about twice as many vacancies in the appellate and district courts to fill as Obama had. He was at about 100. Obama was about 50. And now we're up to like 138 or 40, kind of depending on the shifting math as people get confirmed. And Trump has already confirmed 12 judges, including 8 to the appeals courts, which is running way ahead of Obama, or at least somewhat ahead of Obama at this point, as well as other previous presidents going back to Nixon. What you have to remember about these appointments is that they are lifetime appointments. They come with lifetime tenure. And so long beyond a presidency, these judges will be exerting influence. We pay lots of attention, or at least some attention in the media, to the Supreme Court, but it's an outsized form of attention because the Supreme Court only takes several dozen cases a year. Most final judgments come from appeals courts or from district courts. And district courts also do what's called fact-finding. They're the ones that establish the record in the case. And there's usually a lot of deference on the part of higher courts to that record. So these are judges that play an enormously important role. You know, we saw that in the cases about Trump's travel ban. We saw district court judges blocking that ban. We know that these people matter. And yet it is hard in this swirl, this like faucet of news right now, to pay enough attention to them individually.
And there's probably nothing to be done. And the Democrats, to some degree, brought it upon themselves because they changed the rules in the Senate so that judicial nominees can't be filibustered except Supreme Court nominees. And that was because all of Obama's judicial nominees were getting bollocksed up in the Senate because they were filibustering those judicial nominees. And then the Democrats changed the rules so it only needed 51 votes to get a judicial nominee approved. And then, boom, they lost control of the Senate. So the Obama nominees didn't get through anyway, and now the Republicans have this bare 52-vote majority, but now all of a sudden, boom, there's a Republican president, so they sort of have carte blanche.
Right. I mean, I think of this as this phrase, constitutional hardball, which comes from a law professor named Mark Tushnet. These moments where there's play in the joints of the Constitution. It doesn't say anywhere in the the filibuster is not in the Constitution. And this question of how much deference the Senate should give the president playing the Senate's role of advising and consenting on judgeships. We don't have a clear playbook laid out in the Constitution. So it used to be in the older days where the Senate was a more genteel institution, the filibuster was a way to try to moderate against extremely partisan choices. But for the most part, senators essentially confirmed the president's choices. And then we've moved away from that. And we could have a whole discussion about who moved further first. Both Democrats and Republicans mm-hmm. share some responsibility. Mm-hmm. But you're right that Harry Reid, when he was the Senate Majority Leader, got very frustrated with the kind of, you know, the Republicans then were blocking every single Obama nominee that they could. And so he ended the filibuster for lower court appointments. And now you're right. The Democrats are essentially powerless to stop the Republicans. And these are, as I was saying, these very long term decisions. So it's not like you know, changing the EPA changing a rule or even passing a law where the next time after the next election, this will, could get switched. It's something that remains entrenched.
And we were talking about sexual harassment, sexual abuse. And of course, one of the main things that everybody says needs to be done for this to really stop for the long term is that there have to be as many women in power as there are men. And I think I saw the stat of the 18 Trump judicial nominees so far, 14 of them, is that the right number, have been white males. So both on a gender basis and a racial basis, just putting the thumb on the scale of justice back in the direction that it always was, rather than trying to equal the playing field a little more.
Yes, I think that certainly most of these nominees are white men, and that's not really a surprise because the people who are picking these judges are deeply conservative, and it's just easier to find like-minded folks among that pool of people. You know, what we're really seeing is a kind of machine, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, a very effective operation from the Federalist Society, which is a training ground and meeting place for conservative lawyers and judges, and then the Heritage Foundation, you know, a think tank. They've really very effectively generated a list of candidates, and the Trump administration, with Don McGahn, the White House counsel, heavily involved, has been pushing those people through.
I want to just touch briefly before we run out of time on the Mueller investigation. Again, for you, as somebody who watches Legal Affairs, I'm sure you're following this with great interest. I don't know that we've talked so much here with you about Mueller, but one of the striking developments in the last week has to do with Jared Kushner, who keeps getting found to not be disclosing things. Like so many people in Trump's orbit have not disclosed things with respect to Russia one way or another. And in this case, Kushner told congressional investigators about Russia that he did not communicate with WikiLeaks and did not recall anyone on the Trump campaign who had, according to a source with knowledge of his testimony telling CNN. But it turns out Kushner did receive and forward an email from Donald Trump Jr. about contact that Trump Jr. had with WikiLeaks. And I guess he was now accused by the Senate Judiciary Committee of failing to disclose this contact. What do you make of it? How serious is this for Jared Kushner or for the whole Trump enterprise?
You know what I keep thinking about is the drip of revelations that we're seeing. Ryan Lizzo wrote a good piece in The New Yorker for The New Yorker last week about this, that revelations that would have been shocking during the campaign are now coming out in this way where, first of all, it's just hard to keep track of them, right? It's like, how does this fit into the bigger picture of contacts? And then the second thing is that we get kind of numb to them a little bit, that with each one we think like, okay, well, is this the thing, is this the straw that's going to break the camel's back, is this the moment where these allegations of collusion start to veer into something criminal or something that Congress would feel forced to take action? And each time the answer seems to be, well, not quite, and then that feels like it sort of raises the bar. But what I notice is what you were pointing to, this real pattern of omissions on the part of Kushner and Don Trump Jr. and Jeff Sessions and other Trump officials, in which they have not disclosed contacts with the Russians, and their reasons for not disclosing, I don't think we have a good explanation other than like, oh, gee, I forgot.
So we don't have the actual collusion, if there was actual collusion, in terms of, you know, I guess what would really rise to the level of there it is, with Trump sharing something about Clinton or the Democrats with Russia so that Russia could disseminate it through WikiLeaks or something like that. But so many instances of people in Trump's orbit going to lengths to hide things, you know, or mysteriously forgetting, Jeff Sessions is still forgetting, contacts that they had, that it seems like they must be hiding something.
Right. I mean, one starts to wonder, like, okay, well, if this is the piece of information, if contact with the Russians is the thing and again that they're not disclosing, there must be some reason for that. But that's a kind of like, double negative way of thinking. And I think what we have to assume is that Mueller and his investigators are figuring things out if there is something to figure out, and they know more than us. That was very clear with the indictment, the guilty plea of George Papadopoulos, the Trump surrogate who'd been working on different Russian and foreign contacts. And when he pled guilty, and that took everyone by surprise, that was a guilty plea from a month ago that we didn't know about. I think that suggested that the public's picture, while there have been a lot of leaks and we know some things, it's not complete.
Patience.
Exactly. And, you know, patience matters in this case because Ty Cobb, Trump's lawyer, has been promising that this investigation is going to be over really soon. I mean, at one point he said Thanksgiving. But now we know there's been a big request just last week for a lot of documents from the Trump campaign. And so that promise, I think, is evaporating. And then, of course, the question will be, is Trump going to continue to allow this investigation to go forward?
You know, they say the other Ty Cobb once killed a man. And he's in the Hall of Fame anyway, which I guess brings us back to Roy Moore, and we will have to end this conversation. Emily Bazelon, legal affairs watcher and more for the New York Times Magazine and Yale Law School and the Slate Political Gabfest. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great holiday.
You too.